This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Pick of the Week 769, brought to you by Macroverse, next generation comics plus Webtoon. Download the app at www.macroverse.media. And iFanboy listeners just like you who are washing their hands and wearing their masks still 1 year later. Fanboy Pick of the Week, episode 769. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and sitting in for Josh Flanagan this week, Dr. Reinhaupt.
Hey!
And, hey, it's our former co-host, the Internet's Paul Montgomery.
Hi, hello. How are you?
How are you guys doing? The Animation Brain Trust is sitting in on the Pick Show this week.
Yeah, cartoons.
Yeah, we can talk about cartoons. We are iFanboy, and every week we read a bunch of comics, and one of us picks our favorite book, called it the Pick of the Week. We'll talk about that book, other books, the patron pick, listener mail if we have time, probably not. We'll have fun. It's fun, then the three of us get together. We like talking to each other.
What episode number is this?
769.
Nice.
Here's a spoiler warning. Exercise some caution. There's some spoilers. And this week I had the pick, and I had 26 books this week.
Which There's a lot is going on.
Biggest week I had in a while. And when I finished reading, there wasn't like a book that stood head and shoulders above everything else or, you know, shouted out that I'm the best. And so I had to sit on it for a while. And I kept thinking it back to Two Moons, number one, from Image Comics, which people were surprised by a little bit, and how much I enjoyed it and how much I wanted to find out what was happening next and how much I liked things that happened in it. And that was the book that I kept thinking about, and that's how it became the Pick of the Week. Written by John Arcudi, art by Valerio Gian Giordano, colors by Dave Stewart, letters by Michael Heisler. And you think with a creative team like that, it'd have been a dark horse, but it's not. That's an Image.
Oh, it's not a dark it's not a dark horse?
No. I thought the same thing. So this is the story of a Civil War soldier. He's a Kiowa? Is that what's this tribe? I forget what it said.
The Pawnee. There.
Pawnee. I'm reading something else with a Kiowa character in it. He's been having visions of his dead grandfather and of demons while he's out fighting the Confederacy, and that leads to problems.
Fighting for the Union against the Confederacy.
Right.
Yes.
That's pretty much how it worked, wasn't it?
I know. The way you said it, it could have been slightly unclear. I wanted to make sure we knew who was on what side.
Okay. So he's on the Union side fighting for the Confederacy. And he is someone who was, I believe, raised in a white household.
Yep. According to the essay in the back by John Arcudi, he's been wanting to do this story for a while, and
it should be in a story. I don't want to find out character details in an essay in the back.
Yeah.
This is the De Rigueur essay we talk about all the time, in the back of Image number ones, in which the writer tells you about why they wanted to make this book. Fine. But don't reveal character details in the back.
I want that essay at the back of the the first trade, right? They used to be like, trades used to always have intros, remember? Right.
Yep.
That's where I want an essay. I don't want an essay at the back of every number one issue.
Yeah, every book, you open it up on the second or third page, it's got an essay by Roy Thomas, usually.
Or Mark Waid.
I think that's like most of it. Yeah, it's either Roy Thomas or Mark Waid. It doesn't matter if they wrote it or not.
Right.
If they wrote the original book, but just Roy Thomas has an encyclopedic knowledge of what happened and when. I've been reading a lot of the old Conan stuff, so
anyway. I'm
seeing a lot of Roy Thomas. Anyway,
Two Moons.
Sorry.
So that's okay. Two Moons. So he's, what is his name?
His name is on my sheet of paper. It is Virgil Morris.
And so, Virgil is, he's just a foot soldier, he's a private, and he meets a pretty young Irish nurse, and he has a vision of his grandfather, who is dead and he has never met, in the hospital, in the field hospital. And he's seeing, demons at night, and he has a horrible sergeant who looks already like a demon.
Yeah, that dude's scary.
And there's this big, crazy two-page spread battle scene in the middle where there's an attack by the Confederate division against their division. And man, it's just insane what's going on in that two-page spread. But the art by Valerio Gian Giordano was terrific, I thought.
I had a question about that.
Yep.
That particular spread.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the digital format that I read that book, the blues and grays of the uniforms look very close.
Yeah, that was an issue. I had to double check. There's like a couple of panels where it's a close up on a specific commanding officer, and I basically had to check the facial hair to see where they have
right. Red. And so I could not. And I don't know if that's intentional.
Well, the grays that the Confederacy wore were bluish gray.
Sure.
So Dave Stewart's got 100 million Eisner Awards for coloring. So I have to assume he did some research on...
I shouldn't question it?
No, you can certainly question it. I'm just saying I've got to assume he did some research on color.
No, but I mean, like, do you think it's... you could heighten... you could up the saturation on the blue. You don't have to be completely historically accurate. As John Arcudi says in his backup essay, that he's using a little bit of license on historical accuracy.
I didn't necessarily agree with you, but I'm looking at one page here where... Okay. I'm going to agree with you here. Where after the big battle where they have the rebel soldier stuck in the barbed wire and Virgil's standing there, his uniform there looks a little grayish. Do you see what I'm talking about?
So it's like I was wondering if it's like, is it, like how important are the differences or like, we're, all flawed people and...
Right. Is the lack of such huge distinction commentary on the lack of distinction between these two armies... in the horrible stuff they're doing.
Right. So I didn't know that if that was an artistic choice or if, I don't know. If that stood out to you, I didn't know.
I didn't have a problem while reading it, but I can see how it would be confusing going back.
Mm-hmm. I, like Paul, did have a few times reading where I had to double check who was who. Mm-hmm.
And so during this shootout, during this battle, the sergeant is he's shot from across the river by a sharpshooter from the rebel side, and he turns into a demon. And no one else sees it but Virgil. And so Virgil has to shoot him again. And so now his troops think he is a murderer. And they already are suspicious because he's not white.
Right.
I thought there was a lot of interesting things going on here. I loved the art. Josh and I often complain about the inability to tell just regular genre stories without injecting supernatural elements. So I think that's why a lot of people were surprised this was the pick.
Yeah, I thought of that as well. I was like, I know Josh has loves, and you too, love historical comics. So I thought this would be interesting when I saw it in the solicits. And then it having a supernatural bent, I didn't know if that would, is it worth it to have an historical book with the supernatural thing? Or does that just make it worse?
I think it's the only way it gets published.
Sure.
Unless it's a big name creator who wants to do something like that, it's hard.
I don't know. I really liked it. I thought it came across.
I obviously really liked it. The pick of the week. I thought it was good.
But to me, it wasn't so much a fantasy book, more of a horror book, right? Because this guy is having these visions that only he keeps seeing, and they're usually associated with death or something creepy and scary. And like, I thought it was a very effective storytelling device to kind of separate this guy's experience in the war from his compatriots. Even though he's already separated culturally by being a native person. So I thought it was really cool. Well done.
Yeah, I think there's a reason for it to have this twist, this supernatural or horror twist. It's not like zombies for no reason. Like zombies in this. It's the whole catalyst is seeing his grandfather. And that was actually the corpse of his real grandfather who he'd presumably didn't know or had seen before. But when he sees him,
he's alive.
The vision that he has is that he's alive and, and giving him this message. And then you find out that the whole time he's been there, he's been dead, actually.
Right.
With everything going on, like, so fraught, you know, in the Civil War with varying cultures and stuff. But then to also have, you know, a character who was raised by white people and to be disconnected from his culture and its mythologies and beliefs. What does that do to a person, and how do you, you know? So it's interesting. I think it's an interesting choice for a character, and I'm curious to see, because I think this Two Moons thing has to do with the dichotomy between him and then this Irish girl, and presumably we're going to see more.
Yes, according to the essay. The essay laid it all out.
Per the essay, exactly. Like, if I just read this issue, I would think that we'd just see her that once.
Right, right.
And never again, but apparently there's going to be more to that, so...
There's just a lot of fun things going on here, and a writer like John Arcudi has been around for a long time, and so it was exciting to see him get to do a story set in the Civil War, which is not a comic we often get. There's little Civil War mustaches, which are great. Valerio Gian Giordano is really good. I'm sure a lot of artists are not like wanting to really draw a Civil War story, but because it's got horses and it's got a lot of guys in uniforms, but I thought it was a terrific job. There's some really impactful panels here. When the sergeant kills the wounded Confederate was jolting.
Yeah, it's like people getting shot in the neck and like just really horrific stuff between the Civil War and the supernatural elements. Great choice of artist for this.
Yeah, looking down the barrel of Virgil's rifle as he shoots the Confederate captain.
Yes.
Just some really nice panel work here. And again, that big two-page spread, there's just a lot going on in that battle. I was really impressed by this. Actually, wasn't sure I was going to read it. I saw the cover. I saw it was this guy in a Civil War hat. I actually thought he was black. I thought it was going to be a whole different kind of story.
Same.
And I thought, well, Two Moons is probably like a werewolf in the Civil War story. I don't really want to read that. But then I was like, ah, what the hell? And so I was taken right away.
I see John Arcudi's name, and I know it's going to at least be thoughtful and come from somewhere interesting. So
yeah. So this was the pick, Two Moons, number one. And it's been a long time since an Image number one's been picked. The Image is sort of in a rocky spot, but I enjoyed this one.
But much like Rocky, they've now climbed the steps and are doing the dance at the top of the stairs.
At least this
with
week.
With a pick of the week.
So I was very close to also picking Captain Marvel 26, written by Kelly Thompson, Lee Garbett on art. And this is the final issue of the current arc in which Captain Marvel got zapped to the future and has to team up with all the kids of her friends to defeat Namor's obnoxious son. And this was just a rollicking good time of an arc. And it reminded me a lot of very classic Marvel comics. We've been talking a lot on the show about the Gosh scale, which is the good old superhero comics. And this is this feels like that in a very classic way, in which the story is somewhat resolved because Namor's son gets zapped into the past. And so she's got to continue to deal with that. But then she comes back and there's a whole soap opera element where she, in the future, saw Rhodey's daughter. Rhodey is her current boyfriend, but the daughter wasn't hers. So she breaks up with him. And so it was very like, it used to be that in old way they used to write comics was you had an A plot, a B plot, and a C plot. And then the A plot finished, the B plot became the A plot, the C plot became the B plot. And then there was a new C plot. You know, it was this very formulaic way of keeping a story going. It's something that was developed in soap operas. This felt very much like that here. And I liked the feeling of the arc is over, but the story is continuing on, not necessarily as the main plot, but it'll keep going. And that's something you don't often get now. It's often, you know, things are written for the trade, the story kind of ends, and you start over again with a new arc. This was really fun. And I know you guys read this, even though you haven't read the other issues. I'm curious what you thought of having read the final chapter of this.
Yeah, I maybe would recommend going back a few issues, like to the start of this particular arc, but it's always fun every once in a while to just jump in on something, either midstream or at the end, because it is an ongoing story. And there is always going to be something new coming in. And, you know, you find your footing and you're like, okay, this is the son of Spider-Woman. Okay, I get it. And then we'll actually talk more about this in some of the other books. But sometimes it is fun to just jump in there and see the high concept stuff. And there's always some way to ground yourself and be like, okay, I'm familiar with this character. This will resolve itself eventually. I think this was fun because it's not just super dystopia future. It's the 2050s.
Yeah.
Where she ends up, and but it's fun to see familiar characters and ideas. Like, okay, this is, like I said, this is the son of Spider-Woman, so that's her best friend, and Spider-Woman Jess is older at this point, and she plays a significant role. And yeah, I like the soap opera aspect of it. I think I was really drawn to this conversation that she has with Rhodey, because
yeah, it was a good one.
It's like, you know, you. I don't want to say it's rare, because I'm sure we've seen this same situation somewhere else, because there's just so much in media in terms of future stories and and Days of Future Past kind of things.
All of DC right now.
For a character like Carol and a character like Rhodey, who we know so well over the years, this is a fun a wrinkle to throw in it, that she really likes this girl that she met in the future. And it happens to be the daughter of her boyfriend, but she has a different mother. It's not her. She's not the mother of this girl. So she has this thing like, I made this friend and I want her to exist. And I think she's beneficial and a hero in the future. And so do I put, my selfishness about my relationship and this person that I really care about ahead of that? Or do I try and create the future that I want to see by walking away from that?
And it's hard because it's a possible future, right? As all these things are. Right. And I think they even acknowledge that it's a possible future. But yeah, Rhodey says that, some possible future you experienced. And the question is, do you give up certain happiness because you're in it right now and you know you're happy, versus the possibility of this woman never existing? And it's a hard choice to make for her.
And it goes into like a thing that will come up in therapy often about like self-fulfilling prophecies. Mm-hmm. Does it only exist because you make it so?
Right.
So that's an interesting wrinkle that you can explore in comics like these, and not necessarily in more realistic forms. So this is some fun that you could have in comics while also exploring, human psychology and that
kind of thing. Connor, why does Emma Frost have a small shark pet?
I don't know the answer to that. They may have said why, but
I've seen that shark pet before in promotional materials and was interested, and I don't know if they said why.
I mean, I'm a fan. I'm here for it. I just did. There was no context. I didn't need context, but I was curious.
Kelly Thompson did an incredibly good job of fleshing out these future characters in this short arc. Like, I loved Thor's daughter in this. I loved Rhodey's daughter in it. They were the two main ones that she sort of befriended. And they were great characters, even though we only met them for about four issues. She's a great writer, and she's really tuned into this world. And, I'm 26 issues into Captain Marvel, probably more than I thought I'd be when I first started it. And I'm really liking it. And when it comes out, I'm really excited to read it.
And it seems like she's getting even better at balancing sort of the high concept superhero action with, like, she's always been a very funny writer.
Yeah.
I feel like she's getting better at weaving comedic bits into the big action set pieces in a way where it all kind of fits together really nicely. Like at the beginning of the issue, when she wants to toss Namor Jr., into the sun, but she can't because Hisako has her armor down over the city, and so instead she just throws him at the force wall, and it says toss.
and she's also really good at group dynamics. Even Black Widow's book was her and Hawkeye and Winter Soldier, and also the other Black Widow. And here you've got basically a team book where Captain Marvel's leading a team of heroes. So she's really good at team books. Like, I think she'd be a terrific writer for the Avengers.
I can see that.
She's great at character stuff, and she's funny. And as you said, she's getting really good at mixing action with pathos and humor. She's very, very, very good. She's one of the best.
I don't think I've read a lot of Kelly Thompson previous to this, but I would like to read more. Because, yeah, there's like big conceptual stuff. Like, I got this big force ball up, but I think a lot of writers can get into the minutia of that, and that can be kind of fun, but then it turns out to be more of like a Dungeons & Dragons source book thing rather than like an actual story.
And that's why I talk about the gosh scale. Like, this is like old comics where I didn't feel the need to explain everything. It's just like, let's just have fun. So let's talk about crossover number four. Donny Cates, Jeff Shaw, Deacon F. John Hill. This is a book Josh jumped off very quickly. I've been sticking with and liking.
Okay.
I'm not sure how I feel about it. Paul, you read it all. Ryan, have you read this book?
Yeah, I was the one who suggested it for the show.
That's right, you were.
So this is number four.
Yeah.
The big high concept here is that there was this event, capital E event, where not just superheroes, but fictional characters from everywhere kind of like broke through the dimension into the real world. And with all that power, there was just it was sort of like ground zero for a lot of damage. And mm-hmm. so they eventually put a dome up. There's a lot of domes this episode. And there's been a lot of consternation. It's sort of politics about fiction, and fictional characters are believed to be sort of demonic by some people around the world. And so there are refugees, and there's a lot of modern day like stuff, capital S stuff, going on in the story. And the big reveal last issue was that this character that they sort of teased to be Superman from a doodle that a little girl did from the fictional world, who's out in the real world. We thought it was going to be Superman, but it's actually Madman, the actual
property.
She
needs to be a better artist.
Yeah, because like she clearly drew Superman, and then what we actually got was Madman, who has a lightning bolt on his chest, not an S,
right,
and was holding a towel.
Yeah.
I guess in both the times that she saw him.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let you talk for a second. My biggest concern, I think, with the book is it's hard to lean on real characters if you can't show them.
Yes.
And there's little nods here, like there's the Ultimate Nullifier in the Museum of Artifacts that they find, but like...
And like they will mention
by like name.
Doctor Strange,
yeah,
and they will show you a character who is a lot like Doctor Strange, but they say clearly is not, and is a differently named character. And one of the sort of conceits they come up with in was the previous issue was the paybacks. And they say, this is a book, and you probably don't remember it. It was canceled.
Right.
And it was it ran at Dark Horse, but it didn't last very long. So, like, it's the illusion of these are real characters, or this is a real property that existed and was written. But because we can't bring in the Thunderbolts or, you know, whatever,
we're going to see them in shadow in like prison cells, but we can't. And there's one point in here where there's a hero who's chained up in a basement being beaten. And I don't know who this person is. You know, so it loses a lot of its emotional weight when you're calling out real characters, but then I'm interacting with made up ones other than Madman. So, or there's a Captain America shield on the wall of the museum, but doesn't have a star. It has a white triangle in the middle. Like, that's the problem
for
me.
It's like half measures.
Yeah, you can't really do the story you want to do, so maybe don't do it. You know what I mean? Like, you can't, since you can't. I don't know. Ryan, what do you think about this book?
I'm interested in it so far. I agree that these are all issues, but there's, well, issues, and this is issue 4, but there are issues with the book. But they don't bother me as much as they seem to be maybe bothering you guys, and certainly bothered Josh. I mean, I think it's cool that, like, you know, there's a museum for fictional artifacts that's clearly the Justice League hall, but that's based on a real building, they're allowed to show it. You know, it's the Cincinnati Union Terminal, now Natural History Museum. So, like, I don't know. I'm enjoying the way that this sort of meta textually gets to play with tropes and the lines between fiction and reality. And I think the idea of just having the characters and artifacts who came over from the fictional world with the dot coloring as sort of their signifying trait, I just think is very clever, and
I think that's neat conceptually
throughout the book. There's a lot of things, there's enough about it that I like, and I'm interested enough to see where the story goes that I'm happy to stick with this for a little while longer.
Donny Cates is terrific, and Jeff Shaw is terrific, and there's things
I'm
do like about
it. I'm a
huge
fan of both of them, and that's why I'm sort of just frustrated with this book more than anything.
I did love the commercial in the middle, and I realize that people might not have, but I did, as a new idea or a format breaker, like they find they're in this Hall of Justice with all the things with, I guess, Judy Dench.
Oh, that commercial. Okay.
Yeah. So they find Valifax, the giant sword. And I was like, what the fuck is Valifax? And then we
you turn the page and it says,
what the hell is Valifax? So it was a little bit more less cursy than my question. But then we get a little scene from God Country, the book that Donny Cates and Jeff Shaw did before for Image, which is where Valifax comes from, and then it gives you a little commercial and tells you where you can pick up the graphic novel.
Okay. Yeah.
And then we get back to the story. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Okay, I want to read God Country now. I hadn't read it. I've read a lot of Donny Cates stuff from Marvel, and I've loved all of it.
His God current Country Thor is a book that he came out.
It's awesome.
Came yeah, out.
Okay. Right.
That's what he got him onto Marvel.
For whatever reason, I haven't gone back and read it, but I want to now. Because I liked the tone of that, mm-hmm. that little interlude.
Yeah.
This idea of this, like, all sword. It's yeah. like it represents every blade out there. And I like the tone of that. This book also has this sort of saga thing, this mm-hmm. narration that it foreshadows things to come later.
Knowing narration.
Yeah, this knowing narration. And it talks about, like in Saga where they talk about, but we didn't know then, but, you know, my parents would get divorced the next day or, have, right. you know. And this one does that with this couple, you know, this girl named Ellipsis and the son of the preacher man guy. Mm-hmm. And it says how, like, this is going to be about their love story. And I feel like there's a lot of stuff that's, like, provocative about the narrative. And it's more of that than the actual substance of the story.
It's
a lot more of, like, telling you this is important than actually portraying it.
Yeah, it's a trend in modern comics right now. It's not a huge trend, but
I think it's a lot of interesting concepts. I think it's a little overcomplicated for its own good. There's like a few too many gimmicks going on. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this one's for me ultimately, if I'll continue with this, but I just like it's weird because I want to say up front that I love Donny Cates stuff at Marvel, and this is just a weird miss, I think.
The knowing narrator stuff can be a little too cute by half, but I think Donny Cates toes the line pretty well. And there are moments where I find it legitimately funny, like when we do have the cutaway to the guy beating up the dude dressed as a superhero who doesn't have the dot pitch coloring, which right. makes you wonder what's really going on there. And then when it cuts back catch. To the scene with Mad Men, and the narrator just says, fucking yikes.
Right. Yeah, that was good.
And I'm like, that's funny. Like, that's funny when the narrator is also horrified by what's yeah. just been shown.
Also, Mad Men ruined Mad Men because I can't say Mad Man. Right. I say Mad Men.
Yep.
Unlike Mad Men in L.A. There's a lot of things in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Future State House of L, number one, from Philip Kennedy Johnson, Scott Godlewski. And this was a book Paul wanted to talk about. I originally wasn't going to read. This is a 40-ish page one-shot because, technically speaking, this is the last week of Future State, even though Superman versus Imperius Lex has one more issue to go.
Yeah, I was confused about that. I've been enjoying the Future State stuff for the most part. I was going back and forth between whether to talk about this or the Aquaman book, which I think is great, and I highly recommend it. But House of Val, I thought I really wanted to talk about because this is going to be the new Superman writer after Bendis wraps up his run. Did this, and then he also did one of the stories in Future State Superman War. It's the Mongol one. It's the one where Superman's a gladiator.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about like how people feel about Superman.
Right.
And this story I thought was really interesting because I haven't been reading the Bendis Superman run. It wasn't working for me, so I haven't read a lot of it. But this felt like, I don't know if they've introduced any of these characters anywhere before.
I think
they're all new concepts. But basically, you've got the Inhumans idea of there's this race living on the moon in the future where they're all Superman-related offshoots in the future. Right. And it's kind of that concept from the Legion of Superheroes yeah. where they all are inspired by the Superman of the past. And then this is interesting because it's like they all take it a different way. Like they're sort of like all aspects of Superman. So you've got like this one guy, Nathan Kent, I guess, or Brandon Kent, excuse me, who is just like a guy in like Old Navy clothes. And then you have Kal-El, who was a Superman with a sword.
There's a Blue Lantern.
A Blue Lantern and her brother, who was the Black Superman, I think, who was the one going by Superman during
yeah,
his time.
Yeah, he's the main.
And that's
Superman.
Rowan and Ronan. And so his sister is a Blue Lantern. And then
there's
you have
a woman who's got like an Eradicator type power yeah. setup with the visor. There's a
the Valkyries.
So like Starfire, but with Superman trappings, which was I she was my favorite.
Theandar.
Yeah, Theandra.
She's the daughter of Brandon. And then they have Brainiac 4.
Which does that mean? Does that mean she's half Kryptonian, half Tamaranian? Because that's an insane power set right there.
Yeah, I think that's basic. And so it's like it's a lot to wrap your head around, and it's like it's sort of like what I felt reading the Captain Marvel book, but right. this is a number one issue.
Yeah, it's one shot.
So
number one.
It's right. Sort of, so yeah. It's like you're jumping in off the deep end.
Right.
And all of these concepts, and sometimes that's too much, but sometimes, like for me with this, it felt like, wow, look at all these huge ideas. And I guess this is maybe a meta commentary thinking about the fact that this guy is going to be writing Superman for the foreseeable future.
Right.
I'm excited for him to explore some of this. Like, is this sort of like that thing where we see, you know, this vision of the future and then we go back and like, how do we get there? And so that's kind of my hopes and expectations for what he does with the character and characters in the years to come. And I think these are all cool ideas.
Yeah, yeah. I like this issue a lot. I'm glad you picked it because I wasn't going to read it. And I think Scott Godlewski is great too. So I thought the action it's a big action book. There's a lot of fighting going on, but you're getting a lot of character into fighting. There's also a guy with a mustache. Looks like the Invincible people. Anyway.
Yeah.
The bad guy turns out to be Clark's actual son.
Pyros,
which
is going by the name Red King.
Which means this was a bad week for Clark's sons between this and the TV show.
Yep.
And then, you know, it's all sort of wrapped up very quickly because, you know, Brainiac 5 summons the real Superman who shows up. But I like the idea that he was a myth, you know, that a lot of the Supermen didn't actually think he was real. Yeah, and they start
doubting because this feels like not even just like a season finale, but a series finale.
Right.
Like, this is everything coming to a head. There's, like, armies of doomsdays. There's a bunch of parademons.
Yeah, this felt like the last issue of a saga you've been reading for the last 5 years.
Right.
With this being Superman's son, it's not Clark and Lois's son. At some point, Superman has a son with Cersei.
Right, because he's been alive a long time. Mm-hmm. Lois is long gone at this point.
And then the original Superman who fathered this evil or misguided, we'll say, Pyros, Cersei banishes him to like a hell dimension, and now Superman, and this is a very Superman thing, I think, that he was banished to a hell dimension. When he gets out, his first inkling is, I need to go help the people also stuck in there. Like, it's not right. Just I'm free. It's now I've got to bring my son in there, and he could be the Superman that they need in this hellish other dimension.
Yeah.
It happens very fast.
The turn happens quickly. Like, he shows up, he knocks his son down and says, hey, you could be the man I've always thought you could be. Come help me. And he goes, okay. Like, that was the only kind of negative. And it wasn't, like, a huge negative because they don't have a lot of page space here. But, like, there wasn't even – I mean, it was two pages.
I think that's, like, the downside of a lot of the Future State books. Like, they have huge ideas. And I think the talent that they got to work on it are some new names that are very exciting. But they don't have a lot of space.
Right.
So for some of them, I'm like, wow, you accomplished a lot in two issues, or in this case, like one issue. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like I'm being very forgiving on some of them and being like, you only had two issues. And,
yeah, for sure.
But you told this huge story. And
so, you can only work with what you got.
Right.
And they only had he had 40 pages here. So, you know, I'm not blaming. I'm just saying that was a little fast.
So if someone said, like, this didn't work, like they needed more than three issues or two issues, whatever, they should have done something smaller. I get that. But for me, it's like, wow, they really were very ambitious and they're only sort of held back by the fact that they only had this limited space. And mm-hmm. I kind of, you know, I'm forgiving of that. But I thought, I was like, I would love to see more of this. That's the thing. Like, I was like, I hope that he gets to play with these characters more.
Philip Kennedy Johnson wrote the Last God book that I think Josh read a couple of issues of. I read one issue of. Didn't really connect with me, but I thought this was really good.
Yeah, that didn't connect with me either.
I'm looking forward to his Superman, because this was really fun.
Batman Black and White, number 3. Featured 5 stories, The Calvary by John Ridley, Olivier Coipel, and Darren Bennett, A Kingdom of Thorns by Bilqui Evli and Aditya Bidikar, hope I'm saying that right, I Am the Bat by Bengal, with letters by Gabriella Down, Unquiet Night, Night with a K, by Tim Seeley, Kelly Jones, and Rob Lee, and Legacy by Nick Dragota and Russ Wooten. Was it number 2 was Pick of the Week?
Yeah.
Am I wrong in feeling like this is an old-fashioned style comic that I'm really glad is still getting published today?
No. I mean, it's an anthology. It's really old-fashioned.
Yeah.
And it's a black-and-white anthology, and I don't know. It's funny. I'm almost surprised that DC has had the restraint to never do a black-and-white series for another character that always gets to be Batman.
They're about to do Superman.
Okay.
But all in blue.
I'm very excited about that.
I love the format. I love these sort of short, little, moody Batman stories from various
tone pieces.
tone pieces. Yeah. And I almost wonder, it seems like in this version of the Black and White series, and I've read all the previous ones, that there's a lot more focus on legacy and like what Batman means for Gotham moving forward into the future. It almost feels like there's fewer stories about Bruce and Bruce's life and Bruce's contributions to being Batman, and more about like, what does it mean when Bruce is gone? And I don't know if that's just something that's in the zeitgeist right now. I don't know if it's the future state stuff, or it's just people have bigger ideas about this character than Bruce himself can contain. But I don't know. I think it's really interesting. I always really enjoy all the different perspectives. You know, I would say they don't always hit 100% of the time, but I really like that people are out there taking swings and trying different cool things with the Batman mythos.
I thought there were more hits than misses in this one. I think the previous issue, that was the one that got the pick, was more traditional Batman. Mm-hmm. This almost feels like some noodling around in the future state stuff. I mean, well, it's got next Batman in it, the Cavalry story, which is John Ridley and Olivier Coipel. That's gorgeous.
That was my favorite, I think.
In That's this really, really issue. Strong.
And his sister, Hit Girl.
Hit Robin.
Just beautiful action stuff. The washes on this is just gorgeous. I like that one. And I also, totally different, but I really liked A Kingdom of Thorns by Bilkis Evely, which is sort of like, I guess it's like, my interpretation was it's like Sleeping Beauty without Sleeping Beauty.
Because
it's the prince going up to a castle taken over by thorns and plant life. And it's from the perspective of, so it's like, I don't think they ever mention Poison Ivy, but that's who you assume the elemental force to be. And they don't say Batman, but it's a knight with, you know, bat ears going in and basically sacrificing himself to help her, even though she's seen as this almost, you know, Disney villain, basically, who's taken over this castle.
This is my least favorite issue. There were things I liked about it.
Okay.
Yeah. I like Bengal's art. I thought the story was strange. There seemed to be no point other than to go, it's not a guy, it's a girl. Like, there was no reason for it.
Yeah. The art's beautiful.
The art's beautiful.
I love Bengal's
beautiful.
Art.
Beautiful art.
Yeah.
And the story itself was fine, but then the last page was like, I'm Bruce Wayne's daughter. And it's like, well, what was the point of that?
It felt more like a tryout comic. I don't want to be that reductive, but it the concept is very basic. It's, it's like, this person you think is Batman is actually a girl.
Right. And I like the Cavalry a lot. The Kingdom of Thorns art story I thought was beautiful. I didn't really love the story itself. I actually really liked Unquiet Night, which I was surprised because I really don't like Kelly Jones. I've never liked Kelly Jones's art, even as a kid.
Looks great in black and white.
Looks great in black and white, and I love Batman and Zatanna together.
Mm-hmm.
That's who I ship, as the kids say. You know, Legacy was a mech story, which I'm sure Paul liked, but I didn't really like it.
It looked cool.
I think that I would put that with the Bengal one. I think the art is gorgeous, but the story is just kind of there.
A cool Batman Beyond pinup at the very end, too.
Yeah, the pinups are always been good. Like, these books all are great looking, for sure. But I thought this was the least successful issue so far.
I think it starts off really strong with the Cavalry, with...
Yep. John Ridley.
The Black Batman beating up a bunch of white supremacists. There's kind of a fuck yeah element to that I really enjoyed. And God, I remember when Coipel started on Thor.
Yep.
And I think both of us, me and you, Connor, didn't like his stuff, but it grew on me very quickly.
Yeah.
I remember Thor looking like a chicken. This is back in the forums days.
He did some stuff for House of M.
Did he?
I thought he was the main artist.
But his Thor was very,
Thor was like very heavy in the top and skinny leg, I think. Yeah.
And he had a very broad face. And like, looking back on it now, I like it. But at the time, I was like, "Why? This anatomy is weird. He looks like a chicken." And this is some of the most. This is really gorgeous.
It's beautiful. It's art. Really beautiful. He's one of my favorite artists right now.
The stuff with like the motorcycles and stuff, like it's all across the board, just gorgeous stuff. Like, if he got to do more of a Batman miniseries, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah, for sure. Let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsor, Macroverse. Macroverse, a new next generation comics and webtoons app that is a universe of adventure. When you download the app for iOS or Android, not only do you get some of the best curated comics around, but you also get to read them using Macroverse's unique Tap Story format. Thanks to the unique Tap Story, all the comics in Macroverse are custom crafted for your phone, adding the element of time and a page turn between each tap. This means creators can craft the reading experience to create an immersive experience for humor, jump scares, and ultimately avoid from spoiling the story by scanning the page ahead. That's the way comics would be if they were invented today. If you like comics and webtoons, you'll love it. Macroverse is comics for everyone. Comics for kids, like Rock, Mary, Rock. For YA audiences, like Glitch and Remind. Horror with Dead Town and Dane Yaga. And action like Billy Smoke and Anti. Here are some picks from the app that we want you to check out if you download the app. Remind, the Eisner Award-nominated Remind, and Miyazaki. Miyazaki-esque tale of a young woman looking for her lost cat, but when he washes up on the shore of a sleepy coastal town with a head full of stitches and a startling ability to speak, and no memory of how he got that way, her quiet life is forever changed. That art is really gorgeous in that story.
I'm going to say that's Hayao Miyazaki, the Studio Ghibli creator, yes. And not Miyazaki, the guy from Dead Souls, which is a very different aesthetic.
It's a beautiful book. I checked it out on the app. Dead Town, this series follows Chan, a classic hard-boiled anti-hero, as he plies his trade in a world overrun by zombies, visually inspired by the rich black-and-white style of Touch of Evil and the Maltese Falcon. Dead Town combines film noir and the zombie horror genre in an edgy reimagining of the detective thriller. An upcoming release of season two of Paul Scheer's action comedy Aliens vs. Parker. This is a unique creator's cut of the Boom series, rewritten and reimagined specifically for Macroverse, coming out exclusively on Macroverse on Tuesday, March 2nd. And if you want to get on board with the next generation of comics, then go download Macroverse today. Available on iOS and Android, you can use our special link to get to the app, ifn.by/macroverse, or go to ifanboy.com and click on the link in the post for this show, and you'll be able to get there as well. With the app, you get multiple series, 3 episodes, and then it's $4.99 a month for unlimited access to all the great comics. Check it out at macroverse.media. Or download the app by going to ifn.by/macroverse. Thanks to Macroverse for their support. And enjoy the next generation of comics with Macroverse. And it's designed for your phone. I've been checking it out on my phone and my iPad. It's designed to read panel by panel on your phone. There's interesting creators working there.
It's a good range of stuff. That's cool.
Genre Reminds, definitely. I was like, ooh, this is really nice looking. So check it out. ifn.by/macroverse. King in Black, Return of the Valkyries.
This is number 3. I've been reading the main series of King in Black.
Yeah.
And not a lot of the offshoots, but this is a fun one. And the creators behind it, Jason Aaron and Toron Gronbeck, co-writing, and then the art by Nina Vakueva. Really gorgeous book. I love the art by Vakueva. It's really dynamic stuff. And they have to draw a lot of horses because you cut some Valkyries involved.
Yeah.
And very sharp angles, but very dynamic. And the thing that I've been enjoying Thor, as I said, and King in Black, I love sort of the challenges that these writers are asking artists to draw. Like in Marvel Cosmic, there are things that like, okay, a headless celestial, cool, I can do that. What does a needle sword going through the fabric of reality look like?
Mm.
So it's like they're weaponizing abstract concepts in really interesting ways that make sense. So I think there's some really heady stuff going on because obviously all the cosmic elements, the Valkyries, the afterlife in Valhalla, and all the things that you're dealing with, all the heady concepts in this book, but handled in a very readable, digestible way. Because there are a lot of comics that tackle big abstract ideas and cosmic stuff, but not all of them are super readable. Not all of them are easy to understand. It's sort of like you have to read it 3 times to get it.
Right.
And this stuff feels very grounded while still exciting and awe-inspiring. And I love Mr. Horse. There have been previous Valkyrie Pegasuses.
Mm-hmm.
There was Aragorn. But Mr. Horse, who lives with Jane Foster, and I love this idea for Jane Foster that she works in a morgue as an assistant.
Have you been reading the Valkyrie book?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the same writers from that book. So it makes sense that this is good because that book is also good.
Yeah. I think it's in good hands with Toron Gronbeck. Really cool stuff. And like with a name like Toron Gronbeck with the O with the thing through it, you got to be writing Asgardian stuff.
Right.
I actually think Jason Aaron said in an interview that Toron Gronbeck is the first time an actual Scandinavian person has been on a Thor book.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's great. And going deep into those concepts, and we see some stuff in Valhalla, and it's all beautiful.
King in Black is interesting because we're like the exact opposite of you, Paul. We're not reading the main book, but we are checking in on these side books, which have been lots of fun.
Where you do like Thunderbolts and stuff?
Thunderbolts and Black Knight. Some other ones.
I do want to read some of those, but I've mostly been paying attention to the main series.
I feel like The King of Black has been going on for 10 years, though.
It's going back a lot of stuff, but my introduction to Donny Cates was the Silver Surfer Black and his Thor run.
Yep.
And it all ties in, and it's fun. I can't believe I'm enjoying a Venom storyline. It's crazy.
I never knew that Danny Moonstar used to be a Valkyrie, so I learned that by reading this book, which was cool.
Hmm. Yeah, that's back when Louise Simonson and Walt Simonson were doing some X-Factor stuff and New Mutant stuff, and they tied the Thor stuff in with the X-Men, and that's kind of a corner of Marvel that I really like.
And then there's the Valkyrie that hasn't been named who went off to get Jarnbjorn. Is that a new creation that's sort of bringing in the Tessa Thompson look?
I believe so. I believe that's the intent there. I mean, it doesn't look like exactly Tessa Thompson, but yeah. But you get Brunhilde, Hildegard, Danny Moonstar, Jane Foster.
I was glad that they referenced, because all of this is coming down to like how do you crack open a Celestial and get out the bad stuff. And so the fact that they had to go recover the axe, Jarnbjorn, and they referenced the thing Rick Remender did where he made it so that Thor had enchanted the axe so that it could crack Celestial armor. That was a good callback because I was like, I remember that issue.
I love big ideas like that. And this book has the Sentry in it and yet is good.
Wasn't he ripped in half? I thought he was ripped in half.
He was like, it was like the big shock thing. Yeah, but
Jane Foster is escorting his soul to Valhalla. Afterlife.
Oh, yeah. Thank God.
I don't know if Sentry gets to go to Valhalla. He might be going to his own different kind of afterlife, but some sort of afterlife.
Oh, right, yeah, the afterlife in quotes.
So I just want to really mention quickly Serial Number 2 by Terry Moore. This is the second issue of his new series of books that are all connected to each other. And I still don't know what's really going on, but I really, really liked it. The little girl who's a character who I always forget who she actually is. She's some sort of a historical character. Her friend is murdered while she's in the other room, and she gets the look of evil on her face because she's, as we know from the other previous books, she's a very competent murderer. And so she proceeds to investigate the murder. It was very much like a methodical cop story after that. I really liked it.
This is set in the modern day?
Yeah.
Like the podcast Serial that this is based
on? Yeah, it's an adaptation of the podcast Serial.
The show that invented podcasting.
Yeah, that's why we're all here, because of Serial. So anyway, I don't really know what's going on other than, you know, they killed that guy in the first episode who was having an affair with his, he thought, underage employee. And this is the repercussions of that. And his wife is then murdered very brutally while the main character is in the next room making tea.
Oh, is it the little girl who says male Kimp?
Kimp? So anyway, yeah, maybe that's her.
Wow, that is a deep...
Terry Moore is terrific, even if I don't always know what's going on. Red Sonja 24, the end of the Mark Russell run at Dynamite with Alessandro Miracolo, one of his artists on art. Ryan, what did you think of the ending here?
Yeah, I was bummed. I was bummed that we didn't get a little Bob Q here at the very end. Yeah. But I've been reading this all the way through, and I've never read a Red Sonja book before. I've read lots of Conan books over the years, but Red Sonja, because of the sort of pulpy cheesecakiness of the character, sometimes the cover alone was enough to be like, oh, that's not for me. But this book has exceeded all my expectations and been a very, in the typical Mark Russell fashion, an exploration of the philosophical side of war and what it means to be a warrior in a war, a ruler in a war.
But also a leadership and have all this responsibility on you.
But he does a good job. You know, we've known that this was going to be his last issue for a while. And so he does a good job sort of putting the character back into a position where the next writer can come along and start with a cleanish slate. She's no longer the empress of her own kingdom. She's instead back on the road with her horse and her sword and her talking boar. And we'll see. Well, maybe some other people will see what happens next. I imagine this will be the end of Red Sonja for me. But I was really delighted with Mark Russell's run the whole way through, and I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge how good it was.
And this is exciting for me because I just started this run, just started reading this.
It's very good. It's a very, very good run.
I just, I read the first issue, and it's Mark Russell with Mirko Kolak, and it's, God, the art's incredible. I know he doesn't, it goes to Bob Q, who I also like. But that art in that first issue.
All the art here is of a piece. They're all of a similar style.
Yeah, it ties together very nicely.
But yeah, I love some sword and sandals, and this is good.
I hope the next writer starts off with the talking boar dying. That was the only bit to me that didn't make sense and I didn't like. But other than
hamming it up too much?
Literally.
Yeah.
There was a sister book, Killing Red Sonja, that he also wrote or co-wrote. That wasn't as good.
Okay. I know I did see some one-shots on Comixology that were credited to him, so.
this series, though, was terrific. Paul, something is killing the children. What is it?
Have you guys been reading this?
No.
No? Okay.
Is this the last issue?
Well, it's the last issue for now. I think they're taking a little break, but this was, like, I think this started as, like, a six-issue miniseries, and they're like, oh, this is doing really well. You should write more. Mm. So I think this is the second finale that he considered, but it's continuing to do so well that they're going to do more. But this is the end in that in that one town. Mm-hmm. So this is like the end of season one, basically, is my understanding. So this is James Tynion with art by Werther Del Edera. I believe Del Edera has been doing the art the entire time, and it's great. It's really creepy. The dialogue writing is excellent. It's very natural without being conspicuous about it. Sometimes I think people get too into like sentence fragments and like being cut off in dialogue, and it's a little bit too much for the comics format. You want it to be a little bit more formal. Mm-hmm. But here it feels very natural, and I could see this working very well as a TV series. I would not be surprised if this were picked up.
I think it's already under option. What's the high concept of this?
So the high concept here is that something, Connor, is something killing the children.
Is it DDT?
It's monsters.
Oh.
And the thing here is that only children can see the monsters. As you get older and lose your innocence, you don't see the monsters anymore. But they are still out there, and they are killing the children, Connor. And this is about a young woman with very unnaturally large eyes, like almost anime eyes. This is not an anime-style book, but she has big eyes, and she comes to this town called Archer's Peak mm-hmm. because something is killing the children, and she needs to stop that from happening. It's got this mood about it that I really appreciate. It's kind of like dying towns in middle America mm-hmm. where like she sort of sets up camp in an Applebee's, but it's an Applebee's.
Right.
And she sort of sits in a booth there and camps out. And they're like, we run a business here. You got to order food, and you can't be just set camp. And she's like, are people actually going to show up in the middle of the afternoon?
Right.
Like, no, things are moving on from this town. And so that's a little bit of the metaphor going on. But there's also a big sort of like Buffy the Vampire Slayer kind of mythology where she has these handlers and they're part of the Slaughter family, and it's about the collateral damage that goes on in the town. The sheriff is kind of a character, this young boy who is gay and was being harassed already for being gay, but then is now being harassed because all of his friends died, but he didn't. So people think that he's some kind of serial killer.
Is he killing the children?
But no, it's actually monsters who are killing the children. And he gets swept up in this. And so she's got a way sort of, is this person helping me? Or now that they've seen things, you know, are they damaged and they have to be part of my story? And it's just really great character stuff where you really care about the characters. And it just has a wonderful voice to it. I think there's going to be more of it even like as soon as this year. So I will be eagerly checking that out. But a lot of the issues, if you have Comixology Unlimited, like the first several are free to read. So worth checking out.
All right. So those are the books we want to talk about. There's a lot of books, but if you go to patreon.com/ifanboy and join up, you can vote to add a book to the rundown. Any patron can vote. And this week, we had the biggest blowout in patron pick history. The book was By the Horns, number one, from Scout Comics. Written by Marcusan Nasso, with art by Jason Muir, colors by Andre Tabakaru, and letters by Jason Muir as well. And this book is drawn by iFanboy patron Jason Muir. That's why it won so big.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I should also mention that Scout publishes another book written by an iFanboy patron, Frank at Home on the Farm, which also came out this week. So Scout's just nabbing our talent from us. They're just scouting the patrons for talent, I guess. So, interesting conundrum here. I like to use this metaphor because no one has seen it. So in the 90s, MTV decided MTV was still a place where you went for music videos at the time.
Sure.
And they decided they were going to retire a bunch of the old videos, and they were never going to show them again. So they did a special in which they had a bunch of comedians from the time, Jon Stewart and Janine Garofalo and Dennis Leary and for some reason Chris Kattan, and they were going to make fun of, they were going to roast the videos, and then they were going to destroy the master tapes. They did that for a couple of videos, and then they had Vanilla Ice come out and sit with them while they did Ice Ice Baby. And at first, there were no jokes. And then Jon Stewart said, you know, this is a lot harder when they're sitting here with us. So it's hard to separate the idea of, I know that Jason Muir is a patron from the review, in the same way that if Paul had a book that came out and it was a patron pick, it'd be hard for me to separate.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So
that's fair.
Just caveat, this is a slightly more difficult task than normal. But let's talk about By the Horns number one, which is a story of a woman whose name is what?
Elodie.
Who goes out and kills monsters. She goes out from a little village hunting for unicorns because unicorns killed her boyfriend or husband or whoever.
Her lover, yeah.
And so she goes out hunting for unicorns, never finds any, but kills all the monsters she can find, brings them back to her village and makes terrible soup with them. Meanwhile, the other people in her village are angry that she doesn't help with the farming, and so eventually they cast her out of the village, and now she's...
I like that they actually voted to, like, she's got to go. The soup is really bad.
The soup's bad. You're not helping. You got to go. So they cast her out, and so she's now wandering the earth like Cain to find unicorns with her creature buddy. Her, what is that, like a...
It's like a wolf thing.
It's a wolf with hooves, which actually is what the earliest whales, while they were still on land, would have kind of looked like. So
the earliest whales?
It's a land whale.
Whales didn't start on land.
Connor. With hooves?
They're mammals, yeah. They were
a whale wolf.
They were a hooved, sort of hooved, elongated wolf crocodile thing for a while as they transitioned back into the marine realm.
Her wolf slash deer with also kind of like ram horns, not ram
it's
horns.
It's a Pokemon.
Also can talk to her. This is a fantasy story with talking, you know, there's a red panda shopkeeper. So this is like a very much a fantasy tale. What did you guys think?
I enjoyed this. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting now to know the story that the reason this was probably voted on was because the patron was part of it. But I'm glad that that happened because this is a really interesting book that I'm very curious to see where it goes. Because I love high fantasy.
Oh, yeah. And
I love high fantasy where there are also like original ideas thrown in. Like, yes, there are unicorns, but unicorns are apparently very aggressive in this world.
They're evil.
And are assholes and will gore you to death.
Right.
But there's also like red panda shopkeepers. So it's sort of like, it's almost more like a JRPG, like sort of like a Japanese view of fairy tale Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of monsters and stuff, and I could very much see a video game like, you know, in the Legend of Zelda vein, where you go up to a shopkeeper and they just happen to be an anthropomorphic red panda.
Right.
So I think it's a really colorful world. It's beautifully drawn, and at first I was a little thrown off with because we get this flash forward where she has murdered, it looks like, a unicorn.
Right. So we know that's going to happen. Yep.
I love animals and animal characters. And like there's a beautiful narration of the dying unicorn. And I thought the voice was very touching. And like I remember, it's like the unicorn's talking about like the magic fading or like draining from its body. And I was like, wow, this is really like heavy, like hard to read kind of stuff. But I thought it was very poetic and I liked this. I thought it was, as I read more, I was like, wow, this is a really fleshed out world. And you don't see a lot of just straight up fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
There's some sci-fi stuff in here too. I mean, the first first couple of pages when she's coming back to town, there's robots tilling the fields, and there's hover. You know, it's sci-fi in a very Star Wars way of just like we've got a robot, but it's doing farming labor, and we've got a hovering, cart, but we're just using it to haul monster heads back to town. And so
and people with like metal plates in their heads and arms and stuff. And,
so there's like stuff. Neon signs when she gets to the port city and all this other stuff. Maybe this is a bad thing on my part. Also, I thought the sky whale or the whale dragon was awesome. I know we were talking about her companion also being whale-ish, but in a very different way.
Right.
Good map sequence with her going around the land killing monsters. I've got a new computer, so I've been able to start playing Witcher 3. I know I'm years behind on my gameplay, but I've been enjoying, exploring the countryside, encountering monsters, killing those monsters, taking some meat. In The Witcher, you don't get to make soup. You just eat the meat raw, but this scratched that same itch, and so I had a lot of fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought this was fun. It's not entirely my thing, but it's not entirely not my thing, but I did enjoy it. I thought as you said, Paul, the tension with the town was kind of interesting and fun. Like, You're not holding
like she, like she has this guy who's been vouching for her, and he's like,
it was the father of her boyfriend or whoever it was the guy vouching
and,
for her.
And the wolf character used to be like the companion to the boyfriend.
Right.
I am loyal to him, and now I'm loyal to you because he's gone. So in seeking revenge and stuff, I just feel like it feels very lived in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of backstory that they have at the ready. And so it doesn't feel amateurish at all. I think you'd have to agree with that. It doesn't.
Yeah, for sure.
It feels even if it's not like your genre or your thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's you know very thoughtful and
it's polished for sure.
And polished.
I thought the art was good. I really liked the breakout panels where they would break a character out. You know, like when she first arrives and she takes her helmet off, she's broken out, and the red panda gets broken out. I think that's a fun device. I think obviously Jason Muir is very talented. I think there's a couple of things I noticed like. The hands tend to be a little small, and the characters really, really emote when they're upset. Like the council meeting where they're voting her out, they're all very.
Oh, sure.
But other than that, like I thought it was really strong. The storytelling was strong, and you know he obviously has a great handle on these kind of mythical, you know, fantasy creatures and characters and tech, and it all looked very lived in, and you know it didn't look like he was ripping off any other. Fantasy stories in terms of look and feel.
Yeah, you couldn't say like, oh, this is just Game of Thrones or, right. You know.
It looked good. I liked it. I enjoyed reading it. And I'm glad it was voted for because this is definitely a comic I probably wouldn't have checked out.
Yeah, this wasn't on my radar, but I liked the title. And the concept, while I was wary of it at first because I didn't want to see slaughtered unicorns all the time.
But they're dicks, Paul. They're dicks.
Yeah, there's something going on there. And yeah.
So there you go, ratings on By the Horns out of 5 stars ratings. This is harder because they're in the room. I'm going to give it 3.5, mostly because it's not necessarily totally my thing, but I did think it was well done and I enjoyed it.
Okay, I'll give it a 4.
I think I'm also going 4.
All right.
Sticking with it?
Probably not.
I'm very curious to see where the, you know, I just think there's some concepts there that I haven't seen before. And
I had a heavy week this week, so a book, so I don't think I would have read this if it hadn't been the patron pick and sort of required reading.
Yeah.
If the next issue comes out on a light week, I will probably check it out. If it comes out on a heavy week, I might just miss it, not through any fault of its own, but just from being overwhelmed with other books.
But if I hear it's very good, I would definitely go back and check out a collection. I also wanted to mention Jordan Thomas is the name of the patron who writes Frank at the Farm. The other Scout book. So there you go. If you want to get into comics, cool. Become a Kai Fanboy patron.
Good going, patrons.
Also, patreon.com/iFanboy. If you give the $5 or higher level, get your own superpower live on the show. And we're going to re-increase the number of patrons on the show because we found a bunch of patrons who had upgraded their patronage. And we don't really get alerted to that. Patreon up until recently didn't really have a good system for that. So we had a bunch of people we missed for a while. So we're going to probably go back to 4 per show after this. So just FYI. So we're going to start with Tell That to Culture Club, the patron named Tell That to Culture Club. Okay. And Tell That to Culture Club's superpower is that they can read anything. Any written word they can read and decipher, not just language, but handwriting.
Oh, interesting.
If it's written on a page or a parchment or a stone, they can read it.
It'd be very valuable if this person, Tell That to Culture Club, is a pharmacist.
Right.
Could read all doctors' handwriting.
Archaeologist.
Yeah, archaeologist. Yeah, but if Josh wrote them a note in his handwriting, they'd be able to decipher it. Anything written, they have no problem reading.
This would be useful to me to transcribe my dad's stuff. At work.
What if I just like drew a squiggle on a piece of paper? Would they be able to read my intention?
No, it's got to be actual language. It just if it's unread, you know, they can read any language written down.
Yeah, if you just scribbled something, your intention would be deception.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you had a noble intent.
Yeah,
true of heart.
I assume this applies to like extinct languages too.
Yeah. As long as it's written.
American.
Mm-hmm. But as long as it's written and it's real language, not some sort of...
What if they go to the aquarium and see the octopus like spurt some ink and they're like, oh my gosh, they're communicating. They're telling us things.
If the octopus had intent.
I think every octopus I've met has intent.
They're very smart. I know that.
Then that'd be fine too. As long as Paul said it's an actual thing and not just, you know, we're making it up.
James Kurtz. James, you have the ability. This is of a piece with... Tell That to Culture Club.
Uh-oh.
But probably a little bit more narrow. I don't know if you'll appreciate this ability, but it's what came to me. James, you can communicate to, not with, bees.
Bees.
So when you speak, bees will know your intent. This does not mean that you control bees. They have the choice to ignore you, but they will understand what you are saying.
James can talk to bees, but bees can talk to James?
Bees cannot talk to James.
Okay.
He cannot comprehend the bee's intent. But if he wanted to warn a bee about something or alert them to bee deals.
Or say, listen, bee, I'm not a threat. Don't sting me.
And they would understand that, but...
Sting them anyway because bees are dicks.
Right.
Right.
But they're very important and they disappear.
Connor, so we need anyways, bees.
I know we need bees.
We need
doesn't mean they're not dicks.
I think it does, actually. Maybe. No. They feed us. They give us our food.
And this applies to all bees.
You can be necessary for survival and still be an asshole.
I don't know. I do not support Connor's anti-bee stance, everybody.
This does not apply to murder hornets.
Yeah, what about wasps? Jackets. What about hornets?
I think there's some pollinators amongst the Vespidae branch of the old bee tree.
That's for Ryan to parse. So if you need any follow-up,
ask Ryan. Don't bother Ryan. Don't bother Paul.
Well,
if you want to put out your email address, you can.
Funnily enough, Twitter,
at Haupt.
At Haupt is my Twitter account. And funnily enough, my patron power for Ken Ochilek is also a hymenopteran-based power. And I came up with this independent of any... I came up with this before you started talking, Paul.
Okay.
So it just so happens, but not bees or wasps. We're talking ants, people. Ken has a mutualistic colony of acacia ants, Pseudomyrmex ferrugnea, living on his body.
Oh.
Produces hollow thorns for them to lay their eggs and live in, and Belchin bodies, which is a small little pore on the surface of his skin that produces a sugary, fatty, proteinaceous liquid for the ants to drink and enjoy, and the ants defend him against attackers.
What? Why would you do this to Ken? Why would you give him a colony of ants living on his body?
Because now he's got a defense mechanism. No herbivores are going to mess with Ken anymore because he will attack them with the ants.
So, can we see the ants crawling on him constantly?
No, because he's got all these hollow thorns, and the ants can live inside the hollow thorns, just like on a real
acacia.
He has an ant colony inside of him that he unleashes on attackers.
It's sort of like having an external immune system, right? Like if someone's bothering him, he can just like put a hand on their shoulder and like think to the ants, like, go ants, go! And the ants will just attack the person and then come back to him.
So it's like a hive mind?
Well, they all work together. So the ants are there to defend him. And if they sense the need for defense, they're going to come out and attack whatever it is that Ken needs defending from.
Could they ever turn on him?
No, well, if he stopped feeding them, but he's got the Belchin bodies, which are producing the sugary proteinaceous liquid, lipid fluid for the ants to feed from.
Oh, boy.
This is like that Ninja Scrolls villain with the bees in his back.
Bees. Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go at the $5 or higher level to support the show. Ken, James, and Tell It to Culture Club. Thanks for being patrons. Sorry for the wait. And like I said, we'll be moving forward with some more people who have been in the backlog as we go forward the next couple of weeks. Patreon.com/iFanboy, iFanboy.threadless.com, iFanboy.com/support, iFanboy.com/Amazon. Those are all the ways you can help to support the show. And thanks to everyone who does that. And we have to skip the emails because we went long, as predicted. Let's do some plugs. This past month, February, was supposed to be the show of four extra shows, but Josh dropped the ball on the Talksplode, so you only got three extra shows. You got the Booksplode, the Jack Kirby, the Epic Life of the King of Comics review. You had the Animation Brain Trust, which is the three of us currently on the show now, talking about Batman Soul of the Dragon. And then you had the Media Splode, where we talked about a couple of things, but then the main topic was Cobra Kai seasons 1 through 3, which was a lot of fun.
Listen, shortest month of the year.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Listen, you want to give Josh excuses? That's fine.
You know, fear does not exist in this dojo. I can say that.
No, it does not.
You done screwed up, glasses. You let me down.
Ryan, plug your show.
I do a show called Science Order. You can find it at scienceorder.com. The episode that just came out that folks can go check out is a really fun interview we did with a biologist, Gina Zwicky, down. She's based in New Orleans, but she does some really cool stuff with lizards in the Caribbean and leads frog tours. So if you are
tours for frogs.
It's yeah. tours to go listen to frogs.
She takes frogs downtown, shows them the theater district.
It's a program called Frog Watch. And so if you and there are Frog Watch chapters all across the country. So no matter where you live in these United States, I do not believe it is an international program yet. But if you are interested in going and listening to frogs.
It makes sense because there's a lot of places that frogs haven't been to. So it makes sense that they'd want to take frogs around all over the country.
Yeah, I think the Australians might have something to say about that, given their invasive frog issues. But here in the States, we got lots of frogs for people to enjoy, if they know
how. When this whole pandemic is settled down, I'd like to go on that tour and then leave a Yelp review with a single word, riveting. Riveting.
That
honestly sounds cool.
And yeah, it was really fun to talk to Gina. It was one of those interviews where I was like, man, you're really smart. You're talking about like lizard immune systems and how they evolve on different islands of the Caribbean. And you're clearly a cooler person than me. And you're taking people out on frog tours. So just a lot of fun stuff happening there.
Paul, anything to plug for you?
No, staying out of it.
Staying out of it. If if you need repair work in the Philly area, you can find Paul's Garage.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right. We don't want more customers. We don't want...
Please don't come to our garage.
At one point, I asked my dad if I could produce a commercial for him or do something like on social media, and he was like, I don't want more customers.
If anyone ever needed a reality TV show, it's Paul and his family at the garage.
All these people coming in with their problems.
Head over to iFanboy.com. You can find all of our shows in the Fast History of Comic Book Writing, in which Ryan and Paul were a big part of. They're all there at iFanboy.com. You can still find all that stuff there. You can like facebook.com/iFanboy or follow @iFanboy on Twitter or iFanboy Comics on Instagram. You can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out by following any of those places individually. We are C.S. Kilpatrick on Instagram, Ryan Haupt on Instagram, and Haupt on Twitter, and Fuzzy Typewriter on Instagram and Twitter. And of course, we have our YouTube page where you can subscribe to find all the old video shows, youtube.com/iFanboy. They're being uploaded every week. This past week, we had the pick of the week, Captain Britain and MI-13 #1. Mini, we had a Vault show looking at The Damned, Exit Wounds, and Emperor Doom, one of my favorite Marvel books. And we had a show about politics and comics, and those are a lot of fun. We're still in 2008, so we've got a long way to go. We're uploading those shows every week. It's going to be a couple of years of uploading. So enjoy those at youtube.com/iFanboy and subscribe if you want to keep up with all those shows. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review or a star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, not only for this show, but for any podcast you listen to. Science Sort Of would be another one you can do. Any show you like really does help them to leave a review or a star rating. It helps the people find the shows. And it's a real easy way to support a show you enjoy. Even better than that, word of mouth, tell your friends whenever they come into the garage with a car problem. Paul always tells them to listen to the show. We always appreciate that. He gives them a card with all the information on it.
Give them a USB dongle with a sampler of episodes on it.
You just start burning CDs and give them like an old-fashioned CD. It's like, here, I made you a mixtape, but it's just iFanboy episodes.
Yep.
Yeah. He always leaves it somewhere hidden in the car whenever they fix it. That's a nice little treat for them.
We're just in the CD player when they turn the car on. Just start to play.
Help us spread the word. We do appreciate it. Everyone does that. Thank you, Ryan and Paul, for jumping on to fill Josh's shoes.
Thanks for having us.
This is fun.
And I enjoy talking comics with you guys. We'll have to do it more often. And till that time, I'm Connor.
I'm Ryan. Comics are life.
I'm Paul.
Stay safe. Wash your hands. Be good. Talk to you next week.
Mask goes over the nose.
Over it.
And the mouth.
Right.
Not just one of the
eyes. Yeah. Not just the nose. That would be silly.
And if you don't wear a mask, Ken's going to attack you with those ants.